So welcome, my name is Robert Smith. I'm the Executive Director for Fisher Phillips Safety Solutions. We're a workplace safety consultancy company based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm really happy to my friend and colleague, Travis Vance. Travis is an attorney. He's a partner in our Charlotte law office. And so we're gonna talk to you today a little bit about testing for opioids and cannabis in the workplace. And I would tell you that as a safety guy, this is an interesting conversation to give, because very often for me in the safety world, I'm kind of taught to keep things that I don't like at a distance. And so when I start thinking about opioids and drug testing employees, the safety guy in me says, that's an HR issue, I don't want to talk about it. Well, I would tell you that in the past probably 5 months, 4 months, I've had a number of instances that really changed my outlook on this and how prevalent it is in the workplace. So the first thing that happened to me is in September, I had to have surgery on my right knee. And the doctor comes in, he's gonna prep me for surgery, he's gonna draw his initials on my right knee to make sure he operates on it. And while I'm still coherent, he says, Robert, I'm gonna give you 3 prescriptions when you leave here today. He said, I'm gonna give you a prescription for Percocet. So that's your pain pill, that's your best friend for the next 3 days, and you gotta take it every 8 hours for the next 3 days. He said, I'm gonna give you a prescription for an anti-nausea medicine, because Percocet makes you feel real stomach a little queasy. And the last one, he said, I'm gonna give you a prescription for Narcan. Anybody know what Narcan is? Yeah, Narcan is the opioid overdose counteract drug that basically if somebody's overdosed, you give them this Narcan. So in the state of Virginia where I live, it's now required that if a doctor writes an opioid prescription for more than 30 pills, they have to give that prescription for Narcan. That to me was a real red flag. And he told me, he said, Robert, insurances vary. Sometimes it's $5 to fill it, sometimes it's $150 to fill it. He said, if it's $5, you fill it. There's 2 doses in a prescription. He said, you take it, you put it in your desk at work, you put it in your glove compartment of your car, you put it in your backpack, you put it in your kitchen drawer, you put it wherever you think you might need it. Because you don't know who might just walk into your space and have an opioid overdose. So that really hit me. The other thing that struck me is from a safety guy, following the National Safety Council, while they don't have any type of regulatory powers, they issue a lot of times guidance on what we should do. And they just came out 2 weeks ago and said that employers need to consider employees in safety-sensitive positions, and perhaps with the legalization of marijuana, whether it's recreational or medical, that employers have to start thinking about this. You think about this industry, just about everything in this industry is safety-sensitive, right? From forklifts, travel lifts, pumping fuel, pumping tanks, I mean, doing pump out, all that is safety sensitive. So we'll talk a little bit about this. You know, I will tell you, Travis and I have given this presentation 4 or 5 times here through the fall, different state conferences. We always hear the same thing. And probably what you're thinking right now is, if I drug test my workforce, I'm not gonna have a workforce. I will tell you, it is not a problem unique to the marine industry. It is not a problem unique to Tennessee. It's not a problem unique to Kentucky. This is everywhere. We're seeing it in construction, we're seeing it in manufacturing, we're seeing it in California, we're seeing it on the East Coast, everywhere. So it's not a unique scenario. But why it's so important? I mean, here's some data. A gentleman named Sam Quinones wrote this book, did a study on the effects of opioids. 50,000 people a year are dying as a result of opioid addiction. If we look at this, we're showing that basically 2 million people in America have some sort of issues with substance abuse. I mean, it's pretty staggering when you start looking at these, and it's not where you think. It's starting primarily in middle-class families, well-to-do. I mean, that's where the issue starts. It's not where you think it would maybe starting. So right now, we're looking at 100 deaths a day. That's a lot. What's scary is think with some of the synthetic drugs coming in, the fentanyl coming in, other things affecting this, 250 people a day could potentially die as a result of some sort of illegal opioid contaminated type drug use. You run the numbers on that, that's over 90,000 people a year. That's far more than what we're dealing with other types of diseases, cancers, that sort of thing. Here's the thing, it starts at home a lot of times in the medicine cabinet, just like for me. The doctor gave me that 30 pill pack of Percocet. I took it for 3 days like he said. I still got 15, 16 pills in my medicine cabinet at home. So that's where it starts. These drugs mess with your brain. My Well, for whatever reason, with Percocet makes me have crazy dreams. And I would tell you that when I came out of knee surgery in September, I was coaching a Little League baseball game, and Elvis was my pitching coach, and Elvis was out on the mound talking to my pitcher. And I'm going to tell you, I love Little League baseball, and I love Elvis, but I'm not sure how those two come together. But that's the effect that these drugs tend to have on you. Because they make you feel good, people tend to start to rely on them. So, again, I love me some Elvis. So if I can continue to have those dreams, that's why I can continue to go back to it. The problem is once that prescription runs out, so that 16 pills that's in my medicine cabinet, what happens when I run out and I'm still looking for that feeling? That's when we're seeing people go to heroin, because it's more readily available and it's cheaper. Now, as an employer, you got to think about this from the standpoint of, you know, is the addiction a result of a workplace injury? Is it starting in the workplace? So that employer, that employee that suffers a back injuries are tough to diagnose, right? Doctor goes down, writes them that prescription for the opioid to control the pain. Next thing you know, you've got an employee that becomes dependent on it because of a workplace injury. So we got to think about this in terms of, how are we going to manage this? How can we help that employee achieve that goal of not hurting from that back injury, getting back to work and working safely, but can we do it such a way that we're not giving them the drugs? The other thing that we have to be mindful of, and this is going to be, we're going to share with you in a little bit a case study that's an actual real life, 100%, we just covered the names to protect the innocent, but it was a scenario where somebody was suspected of drug use that ended up starting embezzling from the marina because they needed a way to pay for their habit. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So what do you do as a manager? You got to make sure that you're engaging with your people. We all know the marina industry is small enough. Most of the time, the marina employees become more like our family. So we can generally tell if somebody's off the rocker a little bit, right? The person that was always on time is suddenly showing up for work late. The person that's always calm and cool is the one that's suddenly being agitated. The guy that's just so laid back, next thing you know, he's paranoid. That's the effects of these drugs. Those are the things we should be looking for. So again, this situation may have started at work, may precipitate itself into something else. The other thing we got to watch out for is our workplace is becoming a marketplace. So folks buying and selling, and Travis shared a story of his father's career. His father would be issued these drugs, and somebody would say, can I borrow a couple of pills? Can I buy a couple of pills? I mean, that's the kind of thing we got to watch out for, is that if we have that employee that perhaps maybe gets addicted, are they buying and selling within the workplace? I'll let Travis give you some of the legal stuff there for a little bit, and we'll come back to the case study.
Okay, just before we get there, thank you, Robert. We're going to talk a little bit about Dreamland here. Dreamland is a great book. I don't know if anybody, has anybody here read it? Okay, so Dreamland, I read this book. Somebody told me to read it. And Sam does a great job. He's a former journalist for the LA Times, and he goes neighborhood by neighborhood, street by street, and he walks through the opioid crisis. And this is really how it started. So Johnny from maintenance has a workers' comp injury. He goes to the doctor. He gets prescribed hydrocodone or some other opiate. Okay. He recovers from that. He recovers from his injury. 6 weeks later, he goes back to work. But guess what? He's out of prescription, but he's addicted to opioids. So what does he do? He reverts to other things that are like opioids. A lot of people don't realize is that heroin is also an opiate. So heroin and oxycodone are the same family of drugs. So what happened, it was there were cartels from Mexico that were taking advantage of this situation. So what they were doing, they were starting to sell heroin to these painkiller addicts. So what they would do is they would drive around to these different neighborhoods. They had a pager system. They would contact these people to get a fix of tar heroin. And they would put the tar heroin inside of an inflated balloon. And they'd have about 30 balloons in their mouths. And then what would happen is if they got arrested or if they got pulled over, then they just swallowed the balloons. And this is how the opioids, so people went from painkillers to heroin. Because like Robert said, even though heroin is illegal, it's cheaper and it's more accessible. So Dreamland goes over that whole story. And the reason why I was so interested in it, because that's me there with Sam. We've actually spoken together. I read it, was very impressed with it. And the reason why I was so interested is because he has a whole chapter. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina now. I actually grew up in East Tennessee, in Bristol, Tennessee. But he has a whole chapter about Charlotte, which is where I live. And at the time, I lived across the street from a neighborhood called Raintree. And he goes into the book and he talks about the three most affected neighborhoods in Charlotte, and one of them is Raintree, right across the street. I used to live in Providence, which is close to Ballantyne. So I contacted Sam. We became friends. He's a great guy. So is anybody here, nobody's here has read the book, right? Is anybody here interested in reading the book? Okay. I think I saw your name and your name. So if you guys come up and give me a card or your name afterwards, I'll send you a copy of it. I usually bring a couple of copies, but I forgot, so I'll mail it to you. So anyway, his book is fantastic. I highly recommend you and recommend it to you. And it really breaks down at an unbelievable street level exactly what happened. So getting back to the legal part, as marina owners, you guys have a very difficult situation because in some states, marijuana is legal, some for medical reasons and some for recreational reasons. So there's 33 states and D.C. that allow you to use marijuana for medical purposes. Those are all in the lighter green. And in the darker green, you have 11 states that allow you to use for recreational uses in D.C. So you don't need to have a prescription. You don't need to have glaucoma. You can just use marijuana. Now, what's the problem with that? The United States federal government still says that marijuana use and possession is illegal. So you have two different legal systems, that are opposed to each other. So it makes your job very difficult. Here's an example. Even though some states allow it, and the feds don't, you do not have to allow the use or possession of marijuana at work, okay? So if somebody says they have a medical marijuana card, you don't have to let them smoke on their marijuana on their smoke break. Don't have to do that, okay? That's right. The only way you discriminate against a medical card holder is that you drug test that person because they have a medical card and not because it's random. If you do that, then it's discrimination. Otherwise, the safety concerns that Robert mentioned would trump that because you don't need somebody operating a forklift with their glaucoma prescription, right? So what about off-site use and positive drug tests? So what if somebody says, I have a medical marijuana card, I need to take off the weekend because my glaucoma is acting up and I need to just smoke all weekend or whatever. Do you have to accommodate that? So employers in these states, California, Oregon, so forth, they said you do not have to accommodate off-site marijuana use. However, Massachusetts in July of 2017 said you might have to accommodate off-site medical marijuana use. So the benefit or the point to be made is that if you have a medical marijuana card user in your workplace and they ask for time off because of a medical marijuana related issue, then you should probably get an HR consultant or a lawyer involved and walk through what the ADA requires, the accommodation process, and go over that. They call it the interactive process as part of the accommodation. But it's crazy that you have to think about that. But if someone has a medical marijuana card and they want to use it off-site and they need you to accommodate that use, then you probably need to get a counsel involved. So recreational marijuana, you can still have a zero tolerance policy for use at the site. What if you want to have a more relaxed standard? So that was the whole point of this whole presentation, because we get this question all the time. How many people here have ever wondered, should I not drug test my applicants for marijuana use? Anybody thought about that? Okay. And the reason for that, especially in some states like Colorado, is because if you drug tested applicants for marijuana use, then you never get anybody to work for you, right? So here's the thing. You cannot drug test applicants for marijuana if you want to. No problem with that. Except to your point, you have to treat everybody the same way. So no applicant gets drug tested for marijuana use. You have to be completely the same to everybody, and that's because of discrimination issues, okay? Now, the problem with that especially for you guys, is that let's say you're not drug testing anybody for marijuana. They come to work for you, and then they have a forklift accident that hurts or kills one of your renters for the houseboats that you have at the marina. Then some lawyer out there is going to dig into what your drug testing policies are, and they're going to say, hey, those guys at, you know, ABC Marina don't drug test their applicants for marijuana, so they knew that somebody probably was going to have an accident, and they knew those guys were using marijuana. So if you decide not to drug test pre-hire, then you've got to enforce your drug testing policy and your drug use policy very strictly. You got to be looking for marijuana use, paraphernalia, what Robert said, people acting strange, reasonable suspicion, and you got to drug test randomly, and you got to drug test when you have a reasonable suspicion. You got to enforce it. You got to fire those people. We'll talk about later why you might not want to on the opioid side, but you got to be very, very strict with that policy, because if you're not, then you're facing maybe a lawsuit or a wrongful discharge type claim in the future. So Mr. Sessions said back in 2016, we mentioned that it's still a violation of federal law to distribute marijuana in the United States, and also said good people don't smoke marijuana, which is interesting. Now Robert's going to talk about the case study, and then we'll get back to drug testing.
So like I mentioned earlier, the facts here are 100% accurate, came from a client. This particular facility shut down typically a week before Christmas and laid their folks off until about the 1st of February. So this employee came back in earlier this year after that layoff and just wasn't the same person he was before. Other employees started reporting unusual behavior to the manager, saying, hey, when this guy's on his lunch break, he's sleeping. One minute he's you know, talking really, really fast. The next minute he looks like he's about ready to pass out. He's suddenly paranoid. And what ended up happening is, you know, the team just ended up alienating this guy. So basically, they suspected he was using some sort of drug, expected he was using it at work, you know, travel lift involved, hydraulic trailer involved, you know, 50-foot boats involved. So all of a sudden, they kind of shoved this guy off on the side and said, look, we don't know what you're doing, but we don't want you to be doing what we're doing, you know, working around us. So the manager confronts him. This went on. He started in February, so this went on for about 8 weeks. The manager confronts him and basically says, hey, what's going on with you? The guy came back, basically denied using any type of substance, basically said he was having a hard time at home. He and his wife were having a difficult relationship. They just had a baby. He wasn't getting a lot of sleep. So the employees, the other team members kept giving the feedback. They used this term tweaking, basically saying the guy was using drugs. So the manager wanted to do the right thing. This guy was a longtime employee, was a good employee. The manager wanted to try to do the right thing for him. So he went back to him and offered him treatment, you know, offered to get him some help. The employee kept denying that he was using any type of substance. So in May, the manager calls together basically a team meeting. Says, everybody, we're going to get together. And basically, the manager called the meeting, and then on the way upstairs, grabbed this employee and said, hey, this is what's getting ready to happen. He said, you're going to stand in front of your coworkers. You're going to tell them what's going on with you. So the employee goes up, basically, you know, denies using any type of substance, never mentions it, just basically breaks down in front of the team, just apologizes profusely. Again, the idea was for him to come clean and not say that he was using some sort of drug. So he ended up never admitted to anything. The team just basically rallied around this guy because they wanted him to succeed. They've been together for a long time, and things got a little bit better. So that was in May. So we're through the summer season, which you don't know if things really got better. Things probably got busy, right? Things got so busy that they didn't really have time to focus on this. But basically got ready for haul out season again here in 2019, and they reported this guy acting up again. Same behavior as before. Manager goes, confronts him again, denies any type of substance abuse, offers him treatment, declines it. Does the same thing again, calls another all-hands meeting, brings this guy in front of the team and tells him, you know, what's going on. This time, though, the team didn't want anything to do with it. The team basically revolted and didn't want anything to do with this guy because they felt like he was using drugs and wasn't being honest with them. So a couple weeks later after that meeting, the manager terminated the employee, but he didn't terminate the employee based on a suspicion of drug use. What he found out was that for every boat in this facility, they had a process where every week they went through and pumped out the boats on Monday after the clients had been in on the weekend. And if the employee, for every boat he pumped out, he basically got a $2.25 tip. And he would have to go down, and they had a system of leaving notes on boats and that sort of thing. But basically, he went for a series of weeks over the summer and said, I pumped out every boat in the facility on Monday morning. That's 400 boats. So at $2.25 a boat, you can see this guy is suddenly racking up some money. So basically, the manager started doing some checking and realized that this guy was forging his documents. And that became the reason that he fired him. He didn't press any charges. The employee went down, filed for unemployment. The marina didn't challenge the unemployment claim. They ended up paying that out. But after the termination, the manager went and told the team that he had terminated that employee. And he said, Robert, I watched the collective weight of my team, the weight lifted off their shoulders, because suddenly this problem employee was gone. So what do you think? What did that manager do correctly? Tried everything. What else? Yeah, absolutely. So he was obviously doing some due diligence to try to track it. Anybody else? What do you think he did correctly? How about incorrectly? Any part of that case study for you as a manager made you cringe, raised a red flag, said, ooh, I don't know if I would have done that? So you would have maintained the employee's privacy and let it go, right? What else? Yeah. So, you know, a number of ways that, and so as Travis and I talked about this, I mean, from the labor legal side of it, and I'll let him jump into it, but there's certainly a claim to be made by that employee that potentially hostile work environment, potentially can make the argument that he was maybe being retaliated for some complaint he might have made. So there's a lot of things that I felt like could go wrong with that process of pulling that employee in front of a group and saying, explain yourself, right? Absolutely right. Never found out if he was on drugs or not. As you know, in this industry, he ended up working at the competitor down the street. So I guess you could look at that as a good or a bad thing, because, you know, he's down the street working for the competitor, but you don't want to see him go down the street and have the same issues, potentially hurt somebody, right? So what do you think? What do you think if this particular client didn't have any type of substance abuse policy, didn't drug test, didn't do anything like that? Can you see the benefits of having that policy in terms of guidance? Back to OSHA stuff.
All right. What we're going to do, add on to that case study, just real quickly. Let's say the next day there was another employee who was unrelated to this, and he had a forklift accident, and he drove himself to the hospital, was admitted overnight, and then you found out about it the next day. So the first question is, do you have to call OSHA about that accident? Y'all say yes? Why do y'all say? Oh, they said yes. Okay. What do y'all say yes? Did you say yes, ma'am? What about you, ma'am? Okay. Yeah, that's close. What do you say, sir? Okay. What is the law? Close. So the rule is, there's a little confusion there between OSHA recording, that's the first aid, and the OSHA reporting. So if it's more than first aid and they missed any days, if it's more than first aid or they miss any days from work, then you have to record it on your 300 log. That's called OSHA recording. But with respect to OSHA reporting, that means you actually pick up the phone and call OSHA. So you call OSHA when there's a fatality, largely within 8 hours in most states, or within 24 hours if there is an amputation, loss of an eye, or an inpatient hospitalization. That means you actually have to be admitted to the hospital. So if you go to the hospital, you get surgery, they put you in the recovery room, and then you never get admitted, you don't call OSHA. Another thing is that the inpatient hospitalization has to occur within 24 hours of the accident. So if your employee goes to the hospital, they're in the recovery room for 25 hours, and then they're released or they're admitted, then you don't call OSHA. So it's a very, very fact-intensive 24, okay? All right, now the other thing there is, do you call OSHA or do you report it online? Does anybody have any thoughts on that? So you can call, you've always been able to call OSHA. You can pick up the 800 line number and call them. Now in most states you can report it online too. And I used to be a big call guy, because what I would say is that you'd wait until the 7.5 hour, or the 23rd and a half hour, and then you'd call them. And the reason for that is it gives you the most time to get ready for the inspection, especially if you called them at 4:30 p.m., you have all night and they'd be there the next day. But now I'm in the reported online camp, and here's the reason for that. If OSHA calls you, or you call OSHA, they're gonna start asking you a bunch of questions. You may not know the answer to that. And you're a manager for the company, and everything you say is gonna bind the company, all right? And you're probably gonna be speculating at that point. If you report it online, you can be honest but generic with what you report, and nobody's asking you questions back. And I always give this example as to why this is important. A couple of summers ago, I got a call from a client in Texas. It was the safety director. The safety director called me, and the safety director was crying. Okay, this is how bad this is, all right? He had a gentleman that got hurt in Houston, and what happened is they were cleaning out the inside of a pipeline, a gas pipeline in Houston. They were cleaning it with what they call a pipeline inspection gadget, a PIG. So it cleans out the debris on the inside of the pipeline. So what they do is they run that PIG through there. It's almost like a pipe cleaner, a glorified pipe cleaner. But when you hit debris and you can't push it, they start putting high-powered water behind it. So what they did is they put so much high-powered water behind it, somebody had sealed off a valve cover at one end of the pipe. So it was really pushing. Finally, it busts through like a champagne bottle. The water's coming out of the pipe so fast, it moved a Dodge pickup truck 90 feet. That gives you a feel for how fast it was going. Unfortunately, one of our guys walked in front of the water. It split his heart head in half. He was 26 years old, had 7 surgeries in 48 hours. But he survived it. So OSHA, the client calls me, he's crying. He tells me what's happened. So I said, okay, I'm gonna take over the response to OSHA, reporting OSHA immediately. So I did it. So I reported it to OSHA myself. I've done that quite a bit. So what did I put in the description of what happened? Employee suffered injuries to the head and torso after being struck by water. 100% accurate, all right? You could have gotten pretty gruesome with that description. You could talk about how fast the water was going. You could have talked about the truck, talked about the surgeries, talked about the hard hat. But that's all inflammatory. OSHA's got limited resources and limited time, just like all of us. So they get all these reports, and they're going to do a triage of which one do we need to go to first. And if they see hard hat split in half, guess which one they're going to go to first. So OSHA never did an inspection in that case. They just sent us a letter, said we need more information about what happened. We sent it back to them. Nobody was ever inspected. Nobody was ever cited. One of the worst accidents I've ever seen. In fact, my client would have been fined because we weren't controlling the water. The host employer was controlling the water, and somebody from them might have went to jail because they closed that valve cover off. So it's very important when you report to OSHA, do it online, be generic, be honest with it. The second question, the forklift driver gets hurt, goes to hospital, inpatient hospitalization. Can you drug test him, or do you drug test him? Who says yes, going to drug test? Okay. Anybody say no, not going to do it? Okay. Who has a policy that says every time there's an accident, we're going to drug test them? Okay. Does it define what accident it is? Well, as of December 1st, 2016, OSHA says you can still drug test after an accident, so don't get me wrong. They're just going to make it harder for you. You can still drug test after an accident if you have a reasonable basis to believe that drugs or alcohol's use could have contributed to the injury or illness. In other words, we didn't drug test Johnny because he reported an accident or had an accident. We drug tested Johnny because his actions of driving the forklift off the dock bay are inconsistent with sobriety. Right? It's as simple as that. You can also still drug test if your state allows you to drug test everybody that has an accident and gets workers' comp. So Louisiana is a state where everybody that seeks workers' comp, you can drug test them. You can continue to do that. Other states like South Carolina and Virginia say that if you drug test everybody pursuant to a drug-free workplace program and get a discount pursuant to that state-sponsored plan, Kentucky's in that now too, then you can continue to do that. It doesn't trump it. If you have DOT employees, it doesn't trump that. It's just that if you fall through the cracks, you have to go back to what I call reasonable suspicion drug testing. You can actually craft language in your policy that says we're going to drug test you for reasonable suspicion of drug or alcohol use for the following reasons. One, you're stumbling across the parking lot, or you've got alcohol in your breath, or you were involved in an accident that we think there's a reasonable basis to believe that you were impaired. You can actually drug test, I think, more now if you craft it the right way. And I always let people, if you give me a card or email me afterwards, I will send you the language that you can put in the policy that is compliant with OSHA, and you can actually probably drug test more. Just depends on what state you're in, and it depends on what the policy says. So here's the thing. OSHA does, I always wondered why they adopted this policy, and this is what I come up with, is that they don't want you to drug test every time there's an accident, just because there's an accident, or just because there was a reported accident. Because why? Because if Johnny has been smoking weed and he gets in an accident and he knows, well, let's just say it's a small accident, and he didn't want to get drug tested, then what happens? That's right. So what OSHA wants you to do is to make the determination, we didn't drug test Johnny because he reported it. We drug tested him because we think that what happened was caused by the impairment of alcohol or drugs. That makes sense? That way you're not drug testing for bee stings and paper cuts and things like that. So that's basically, if your policy says that and it doesn't fall one of those exceptions, then yes, that's what I'm saying. But chances are probably not. Just depends on what it says. So the other things that OSHA will look at is, does your policy require you to drug test everybody that was involved in the accident, not just the person that was injured? Are you treating everybody the same? So did they have a bunch of guys that were on a crew, on a crane, and the way they were operating that crane was inconsistent with sobriety, one guy gets hurt, did you drug test them all, or did you just drug test one? OSHA wants you to drug test everybody. We talked about the workers' comp benefit discount. You can do that if state law allows you to do it, and there are a lot of states, including Kentucky, that allow you to do that. We talked about the Louisiana rule. That says everybody that gets workers' comp, you can be drug tested for it. You can continue to do that. The Virginia rule, this is what one of those statutes looks like. Every insurer providing coverage pursuant to this title shall provide a premium discount to every employer instituting and maintaining a drug-free workplace program. If that's why you're drug testing, you can continue to do that. And there's a lot of states that have those statutes. Now, a lot of people say, well, Travis, that rule was reversed in 2018. It's not the case. So the rule came out in 2016. 2018, OSHA says, here's a little more information about it, but didn't reverse it. All OSHA said was, you can continue to do things like random drug testing, which I encourage you to do, because that's a good way around it. Have frequent random drug testing. Just make sure it's random. Don't continue to drug test the same guys every time, right? You can continue to drug test if it's unrelated to the reporting of an injury. You can continue to drug test under workers' comp law, as I mentioned. You can continue to drug test under other laws like the DOT. And then this last one's pretty interesting. You can continue to drug test to evaluate the root cause of a workplace incident that harmed or could have harmed employees. The question is, though, do you have to have a reasonable basis to think that alcohol led to that accident as well? And OSHA hasn't answered that question. Here's the thing that's going on here, all right? This administration is not enforcing this rule. So what this 2018 letter was is what I call a little nod and wink from this administration that says that this is what the law says. It is the law, but we're not really enforcing it. So here's how you can get around it. But here's the problem. It's still the law. So one of these days, there's going to be a different administration that actually enforces it. So you have to be ready for that. Because if you don't, here's what OSHA looks like in 10 years. They show up at your work site for an accident. They're going to ask for your 300 logs, just like they do in every inspection. And then they're going to say, give me a copy of your drug testing program. And then they're going to hit you under, they can cite you for this now, which is a new thing too. So you can actually get a penalty for having a drug testing program like that. So if you're not prepared for it with that reasonable suspicion language I mentioned, then a few years from now, OSHA's actually going to start enforcing it. That's what we're looking at. So what about property damage? A lot of folks say, well, we drug test everybody if there's $250 in damage or $1,000 in damage. Can we still drug test for that? Well, why don't you just put it under reasonable suspicion that says if you cause substantial property damage, we can determine at our discretion that that's inconsistent with sobriety, instead of saying you cause property damage at 250, we're going to drug test you. Because every day on the roadways, there are plenty of accidents that have nothing to do with drugs and alcohol. And there are a lot of people who do stupid things on the roadways that don't hurt anybody that do have things to do with drug and alcohol. So you're not drug testing them because of their behavior. You're drug testing them because they had an accident. So you just got to put it under the reasonable suspicion language. So here's some best practices. Robert mentioned this. You need to have a drug and alcohol policy in writing because you can't enforce it. You can't train people. You can't educate it about it unless it's in writing. So the policy would tell employees why and when they may be tested and what would happen if they fail. It would also define what substances are prohibited. It would prohibit possession, manufacture, distribution, so on and so forth, while they're on company premises, on company time, or in company vehicles. And it would also address their failure to cooperate, including a failure to actually submit to the drug test. You would also go over that you reserve the right to look at their lockers, desk, and other company property while they're at the location. Because if you're trying to figure out if somebody is under the influence of alcohol, then you probably want to look at their desk or you probably want to look at their locker to see if there's any bowls or marijuana paraphernalia, right? You know, I always joke that a lot of employers will not have stopped drug testing for marijuana because they can't hire anybody. That's what we did to get Robert on board. Just kidding. He talks about that prescription for all those pain meds, but I didn't realize. I saw him outside last night. He must have one for glaucoma, too. So here's the issue with opioids. That's right. Here's the issue with opioids. You're in a catch-22 because you want to keep drugs out of your workplace. But let's say Johnny from maintenance. I always pick on Johnny from maintenance. Let's say you know that he had a worker's comp injury. He got prescribed painkillers. He came back to work. He's still addicted. He's still taking the painkillers. You drug test Johnny, whether it's random or whatever you do to drug test him. And then, of course, Johnny fails it because he's still on the pain meds, even though he's not hurt anymore. Do you just fire Johnny? See, the opioid crisis has caused us to rethink that because you would think, like, we have zero tolerance, we're going to fire Johnny, no drugs in the workplace, right? But then what happens if you fire Johnny? He's still addicted to drugs, right? So he's going to die on the streets. He's going to be an overdose victim. And then he's not only lost his job, he may lose his life. And so it's time to pause, I think, and reflect on that. And a lot of what employers are doing is they're having what you call a second chance policy or whatever you may call it. And this is how it works. Is that instead of firing Johnny on the first time, what we're going to do is we're going to talk to our employee assistance program provider, and we're going to put him through some sort of drug rehab program. And as long as he goes through that and he graduates from that, then he can come back to work. If he doesn't, then we'll fire him. That way it gives him a second chance, because remember, it was the workplace that got him addicted to drugs in the first place. So just keep that in mind. And this is tough, because you always want to help employees that may have a problem. Like Robert said, maybe they are anxious, they're not acting like they usually do. And how do you help those folks? You want to create a workplace where people will come up to you and say, either I've got a problem, or I think my coworker has a problem. And that's a lot easier said than done, because a lot of times you don't want to get into the private life of employees. There's HIPAA-related issues. But if you create an environment in your workplace where people will open up to you about that, it could save somebody's life. And that also helps with workplace violence issues. I see this all the time. If you see active shooters in the workplace, a lot of times it's because they were just served by their spouse with a restraining order, or they've got something going on at home. And if you can have a relationship with your employees where they will tell you about that, like, my estranged husband is really bothering me, or I've really had a tough time at home, then you can get prepared. You can know what that guy looks like. You can get a picture of him to the receptionist. You might be able to save a disaster. But if you don't create that type of environment where your employees will talk to you about those things, then maybe you won't get that information. So make sure your employees are educated. Does anybody have an employee assistance program? So if somebody is prescribed painkillers, they should be educated on how they can become addicted to that and not just given the medication. If you have an issue with the ADA, where there's a disability type issue, an addiction issue, a HIPAA issue, get some sort of HR consultant or legal counsel involved on that, because those are very dicey situations. We talked about the drastic outcomes that may lead, may occur after Johnny fails the drug test and he's addicted to painkillers, and trying to avoid that tragedy. Revisiting zero tolerance drug testing policies. So basically, for that second chance, you would just take out of your drug testing policy that would be automatically terminated after the first positive drug test. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Well, I think this slide addresses some of that. And that's a good question. The question is, if you don't have an EAP or access to an EAP, what might be an easier route is to talk to your workers' comp carrier about alternative treatment measures. Instead of giving out painkillers every time there's an accident, talking about alternative treatments so that they're never given the opioid in the first place. That might be an easier route if you're 15 or less employees. If you got a workers' comp carrier that's sending them to a doctor every single time that just hands out hydrocodone, then you probably need to change that. And there's a lot of, I took my son to the doctor last Friday. We had to go to an urgent care because he had a double ear infection. And they didn't give out opioids at that urgent care. So fortunately, a lot of clinics are stopped doing that. But just if you're especially a smaller employer, just check with your workers' comp provider and see if they have alternatives to that. That'd probably be the smartest thing. Or maybe the workers' comp carrier will have somebody that can come in or counsel your employees on opioid use, even though you don't technically have an EAP. All right, we got some time for questions, but before that, I just wanted to remind you, I'd be glad to send you the reasonable suspicion language that I mentioned. The other thing that comes up when you're doing reasonable suspicion is you have to be trained as managers and supervisors to look for issues, signs of drug or alcohol use, okay? So slurring speech, glassy eyes, breath, clothing, demeanor, all those things are very important. And I've got a checklist of things you can go through and you can check off when you see those items or those behaviors. Then you can sign off on it as the manager, but you always want to have a witness that sees it as well. And here's the reason for that. Let's say that Robert and I'm the manager, don't get along, and I'm always giving him a hard time about being tardy or something like that. And then one day, Robert shows up, hypothetically, and he's stumbling across the floor. This is light. I've been easy on him today. And I say, you know, I'm going to write Robert up. I got him for reasonable suspicion. You know, he was stumbling across the floor. And then I just sign it. Well, you know, there might be a lawyer out there sometimes, some plaintiff lawyer. Robert hires a good lawyer. And he said, well, you know, Travis didn't like Robert. That's why he put down there that he had reasonable suspicion. It wasn't because he's actually stumbling across the floor. Good so that's lawyer. Why you get another witness to sign off on it as well. And that is all included. And I've also got a couple of documents about responding to OSHA inspections. I think, was it last year or 2 years ago, Robert and I spoke about OSHA inspections as well. Robert, was anything else you wanted to mention about the opioid crisis?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I shared this with Jeremy earlier today. And I would tell you to take this away, think about hiring your seasonal employees. As I mentioned, this isn't a scenario that's unique just to the marine industry. It's not unique to small business. Travis and I had a chance to speak to one of the world's largest automotive manufacturers a couple weeks ago. And in this, they were talking about the cost of drug screening employees pre-hire. And what I thought was genius, this manager said, when somebody comes in and applies for a position, I hand them the application, I hand them a Q-tip and an envelope, and I tell them to swab the inside of their mouth, put it in the envelope, seal it, write their name on it. He said, Robert, 50% of the applicants will basically self-identify. They'll get up and walk out without ever filling out the application. He said, I take the envelope and throw it in the trash because there's no scientific value to it. But he said, I get people to self-identify. And think about that value of that for your seasonal staff if, you know, you're doing that. I mean, I think that one, it's obviously going to give you a better pool of applicants. Now, somebody may slide through that and, you know, swab it and don't think anything of it. But I think we need to think about, you know, how do we maintain the cost? I thought that was the most brilliant thing I've ever heard of from an HR manager. Just something to think about it. But questions?
Yes, ma'am.
If you only have one or two employees, you don't have to involve OSHA. That's not correct. So you would still have that. If you had a fatality, you had an amputation, you had the loss of an eye.
If you have a single employee, you're subject to OSHA. Not much. But if you had an accident, you'd still have to report it, like I mentioned earlier. The only people that are exempt are, you know, certain churches and things, and sole proprietors. So basically, OSHA doesn't care if you hurt yourself, but if you hurt an employee, you're subject to OSHA. But you don't have to keep, we talked about the 300 logs. Some people might be like, what's a 300 log? You don't have to keep 300 logs unless you have 10 or more employees. So you don't have to do that. But if you had a fatality, you'd still have to call them, unfortunately. Yeah, 10 or more employees of the total company.
Now, here's where that, for this industry, is a dynamic that folks a lot of times don't think about. It's often here, well, Robert, I only have 5 employees, right? But we're a family-owned business, and we've got individuals within the family drawing a paycheck, right? You've got the spouses drawing a paycheck, the kids are drawing a paycheck. You've got 3 or 4 employees that work with you year-round, but then guess what? In July, you've got 20 employees because you've got 10 kids that are high school workers, and they're coming in. So that 10 number is basically the number of W-2s you generate in a calendar year. So you got to be mindful of that. So if you're in that process where you're maybe 7 or 8, and then you June, July comes around, season starts, you go up to 12 or 15, you're in that large business category. So you really need to operate in such a way that you're meeting those requirements of large business, even if you're waffling back and forth. Because otherwise, you're in this scenario where if on June 1st, you issue that 11th W-2 or you start that person on payroll, you got to go to that large business for the rest of the calendar year. And there's just no point in going back and forth. You got to go ahead and be a large business.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so the 300 logs is, like this gentleman said, more than first aid, or somebody misses a day of work, or they're restricted in their job duties because of a workplace, work-related injury. So if that happens, you have to put it on a 300 log. It's pretty straightforward once you get the hang of it.
I'll send you it. If you email me, I'll send you a list, because what I find in this is
it comes
is that,
with instructions.
Yeah, and sometimes that first aid is somewhat subjective. For example, if I cut my finger and I go down and I get stitches, that's something I have to record. If they just super glue it, they consider that first aid like a Band-Aid. You don't. So it's you get into that type of scenarios with splints and casts. So whether you come out with an ankle injury and they just wrap it in an ACE bandage, that's considered a first aid scenario. If it comes out in an air splint, that's considered beyond first aid. Yeah. So some of those instances get a little squirrely, but I'd be happy to send you that
yeah.
list.
Yeah, and another one is x-rays. You get an x-ray, OSHA does not consider that medical treatment, so you don't have to report it. And it's always interesting with amputations, because I do a lot of food processing work, so we're always looking for the buzzword is avulsion. Avulsion is the exception. It's the opposite of an amputation. So when we get a doctor's report back, we're always looking for an avulsion as opposed to an amputation. Then we don't have to report it to OSHA. So we always joked that we want to hire this fictional workers' comp attorney, and his name would be Dr. Avulsion. And so whatever you sent to him, he would always come up with avulsion as opposed to amputation, and therefore you wouldn't have to report it to OSHA. An avulsion is basically like a chunk of your skin being taken off.
Any questions related to drug testing, drug use in the workplace? How many people have a policy now? Yeah. How many people think you need one? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just hard to, if you get into a situation like in that case study and you really need to enforce a drug testing program and you don't have one in writing, then it's really hard to do it, because then you don't have anything to follow, and then you can't do it consistently if you're not working from the same document. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so that as far as using drugs, it wouldn't matter because even if it's had a prescription, they shouldn't be at the workplace where it impacts the safety. But with respect to random or reasonable suspicion, if they're back from workers' comp and they're just addicted, then at some point it might become a disability issue. But let's say that's not the case, then what we talked about would apply to both of those situations. All right, well, thank you guys very much. I hope you have a good conference.